You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Andrea Scrima. Andrea, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again, Brainerd.
And you're in Berlin now, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm still in Berlin. We talked together a little bit less than 2 years ago, and here we are again. Yeah.
So today we're talking about your book, A Lesser Day, which has a second edition that's a German edition, and I know you're going to read from it, but before you do, in the second edition, there has been some small adjustments that you've made that's different than the first edition?
Very minor adjustments, really. It's virtually the same book, but we cleaned it up a tiny bit and brought it out again because it had been sold out. It wasn't really available the last 2 years, I think. So it's nice to have that come out at the same time as the German translation came out. That came out in February of this year, and I've been promoting it since then, but winding down now to work on the other book again.
And promoting it, you're doing readings or traveling? How does that?
I've been traveling around. I've been doing a lot of readings, traveling around, going to festivals, and also part of the work of supporting the book has also been to get a lot of my critical essays. I also write literary criticism, and I spend a lot of time getting some of my critical essays into my German. Which is a lot of work. I have a specific voice in German, but my German is not completely perfect enough that I would translate my texts myself, because it's actually, in fact, much easier to write them in German to start with and not to translate from English into German, because they're two completely different systems of thinking. But I spent quite a lot of time with that, getting some of these essays out there to support the publication of the book, and that's what was actually quite time-consuming. But that worked out very well. So I have an essay on Don DeLillo coming out in a German literary magazine called Schreibheft, and then I had another essay in an Austrian magazine called Schreibkraft, and essay on Lydia Davis in another Austrian magazine called Manuskripte, and my essay on patriotism that was in the millions I've just found out since yesterday, is going to be in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, so in the FAZ. So that's good news. So
no, this is good news.
I think I'm about done with that phase now, though. I have to get back to my other book.
We'll talk about that a little bit, but let's just jump right into the book. I know you're going to read for us a few times today. You're going to read a selection from A Lesser Day now, is that correct?
Yeah. I've chosen two short sections. The one that I'll read first is actually the section where the title of the book occurs, and it's in a particular context and creates a certain type of metaphor that then also serves as an overarching metaphor for the entire book and what the book is and tries to be and does in terms of memory and place and time and so on and so forth. So should I just start reading?
Yeah, I'd love that, sure.
How to go back in time. One would have to subtract everything that has come after, shed the skins that have accumulated since, peel them off one by one and forget them. To undo all that has occurred, to have found oneself in none of these situations, to lose entire parts of oneself, to forget, to disappear, to undo oneself. And when my mind carries me back, it is as another. 9th Street, and your sleeping body on the bed in the middle room. Months when we barely spoke to one another. Endless summer months I spent waiting, working, scraping together the money to leave you. How I walked across town every morning to save the subway fare. One long walk from Avenue B to Hudson Street. How I always arrived with my blouse wet from perspiration and with blisters on my feet from the cheap plastic shoes I wore. and always holes in the toes of my nylons, always the anxious hope that the runs wouldn't spread above the tops of my shoes by the end of the working day. A handbag with a sandwich wrapped in aluminum foil, and the Instamatic camera I carried around with me like a precious secret, anticipating the moment when I would find what I was waiting for and press the little red button once each day, one photograph each day. Rust stains spreading out from a spigot and patterns of erosion on a building's facade, and sometimes just garbage on the street or a swirl of oil in a dirty puddle. On some days I found nothing at all, having waited too long and the light having grown too dim, but I always took the picture anyway, even though the film couldn't record much more than a murky blur, a lesser day. And how difficult it was to get those blank days developed, how the laboratories automatically skipped over them, and I had to make a special request each time, had to explain that I wanted these worthless pictures developed too. And in the end, I had to pay for hand development because the machines couldn't be made to print the underexposed negatives. But that came later. Searching for clues, searching for myself, for patterns that seemed to carry some kind of meaning, to contain something that might lead me to who I am. And the job, paste ups and mechanicals, blurred vision and headaches from the fluorescent light, and at lunchtime, sitting on a bench outside, eating the sandwich I'd brought with me and adding up the hours I'd worked, always double-checking the multiplication, always worried about making a mistake. Calculation upon calculation in ballpoint pen on a napkin. This is how much I will have earned by August, this much by the end of September. This much every hour, every second. I'd finish my lunch and take a walk over to the jetties on the riverfront, scrutinizing every surface along the way, the cracks in the asphalt, the scraps of litter along the curb, or what had once been a winding snake of spilled paint on a sidewalk of granite stones, long since dried and hardened, the fluid line fragmented now, the stones having been dug up at some point to fix a gas pipe, a water pipe, and then replaced, fit back together again, but in a different order, cutting the flow into segments of equal length, going first this way and then that. How happy these things made me. Sometimes I worked late into the evening and called the driving service, company policy extending to anyone who worked overtime, and thus even to me. And I would sit in the back of a chauffeured limousine and let myself be driven back to our apartment, thinking about the absurdity of this misplaced luxury and wondering what the driver might be thinking, a young woman with oil paint under her fingernails, hair a wild mess, and a heart torn between staying with you and leaving, staying and leaving. That's it.
Thanks, Andrea. I'm so glad you started off with that one. The beginning of that, how to go back in time, is one of the standouts from that book. Just that beginning. So thank you. That was really lovely. And of course, we're in Brooklyn. So before you read the next one, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book. The listeners now understand a little bit about how you're writing and kind of gently observing so many things, but there's also an overarching structure to the book between Berlin and New York, right?
Yeah. It's based on five different locations. Three are in New York and two are in Berlin. And it's all happening in the 1980s and 1990s, everything leading up to the change in millennium, basically. That's where it pretty much stops. And so it's pre-gentrification Berlin and pre-gentrification Brooklyn, basically, in the Lower East Side. It's another time. It's also another time of art making in a lot of ways. And the book is composed of miniatures. Most of the texts are maybe range from 1.5 to 2.5, 3 or 4 pages long, and they're grouped together in bundles of three, let's say, according to a specific location. Let's say 9th Street. Another location is Bedford Avenue, and another one is Kent Avenue in Brooklyn, where I lived. And then comes Friedrichstraße in Berlin and Eisenbahnstraße in Berlin, Kreuzberg. And these bundles of texts, these groups of three, are separated by shorter texts, like the one that I read at the beginning and that you just mentioned, this How to Go Back in Time. These are shorter pieces. They're much more abstract, and they home in on thought itself to a certain extent, how we think, or what are the mechanisms that we discover about our own thinking.
And that's very interesting that you're saying that both of those, which didn't strike me until now, that Berlin and New York in the 90s were just pre-gentrification. I mean, the gentrification was going on, but still there was quite a big boom after that, especially in Brooklyn and in Berlin, right? That's when you know, the art world started moving there, and it became for both places a different environment for artists, as you're saying as well.
Very much so, very much so. In Berlin, I can speak better about Berlin because I live here. It has many different sides. I mean, one aspect to it is that it's become quite wonderful. There's an influx of a lot of creative people in a lot of different professions. And for me as a writer, it's been a boon, really, because I have an English language community of writers here that I meet together with regularly, and there are a lot of readings, and there's a lot of mutual support of each other's work, and it's become a very valuable kind of, it's become a lifesaver, I'd have to say. It's more than just a valuable part of my life. It's really made a difference between feeling like I'm lost here or if I'm actually in some kind of a context, because I, as you remember, I worked as an artist for most of my career, and I was very active in the Berlin art scene in the 90s. And when I made the switch to writing, I really didn't know what that was going to mean, if it meant that I would have to come back. It's very gratifying to have a lot of really great people here now. And of course, the other side of that is that the rents are skyrocketing. And the income doesn't reflect that. Berlin has been traditionally a very poor city. There isn't a lot here for people who don't have, let's say, an ability to work freelance on the computer. It's very hard for people to find work here, coming in from other countries, and unless they have a business idea of their own. But it's Berlin is not a rich city, and it's not comparable to New York in terms of, my feeling about New York has always been that you can always get some kind of a job there. People go there to work, really, and that's not the case here. So it's really anybody's guess where that's going to go, because Berlin has always been a renter's city, and now it's become an incredible target of speculation, a real estate speculation, which becomes quite frightening to a lot of people. And,
right.
Yeah.
So, let's hear. I wanted to.
Yeah.
But of course, what? No. Yeah. Go on.
No, I just what you mentioned that I didn't answer. The difference in conditions for young artists coming into a city who want to sort of buy time for their own work, to have a studio, to have time to do anything. And of course, all of these things are highly dependent on the economics. And West Berlin in the old days, you know, in the 80s and the 90s still, was an artist's paradise. You could always find space. You could always somehow afford it, and you miraculously had lots of leftover time on your hands. It was very easy to get by here on very little money, and that's really not the case anymore. And so I really don't know what young people coming out of college or not coming out of college but wanting to strike it out as an artist, I really don't know how they get started. anymore because the economics have changed so drastically. And I think that this is something that really has to be spoken about more openly. To what degree money, really, and real estate drastically affect what happens to a culture.
Mm, absolutely. Anyway,
really. Yeah, yeah.
So let's hear another piece. I know there's one more section you're going to read, and then yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the book and your writing before we go. What are you reading for us next from the book?
What I'm reading next is another section that has a lot to do with, I'd say, the spirit of the book, which has a lot to do with chance and with ascribing meaning to certain patterns of things, coincidence, things like that. It's one of my favorite sections of the book, actually. Should I just start?
Yeah, please.
Okay. How many times has my thinking become caught in a loop? How many times has my mind circled around a certain word, an expression that passed over a face and vanished? Around and around, trying to get closer, but to what? That feeling of something being there, circling around and around, but what? That uneasy feeling of something about to be revealed, the quiet panic. And then the moment of realization, its anesthetizing effect. I see this, understand this, yet I don't see, I don't understand. The amnesia that follows when the mind carefully buries its new discovery, only digging it up some time later when it's certain of being alone, unobserved, turning it over and over, sniffing at it as though it were a dried out bone. 9th Street. How I went upstairs and knocked on Laura's door and began to cry. Another official letter from the Academy, full of incomprehensible words, many of which were capitalized and extended halfway across the page. Perilous words, monstrous words, and I, understanding nearly no German, trying to decipher the content with a pocket dictionary. Laura invited me in and sat me down and told me that I didn't have to go, that I could just as well stay in New York. And later that day, wandering around the city with all senses alert to the concurrence of things, a paper coffee cup tossed from a passing truck, rolling along in the gutter and coming to a halt, a dog trotting up to a lamppost and raising its leg to urinate while a trickle of coffee leaked out through the cup's lid and carved a path through the dust nearby. One thin trickle, slowly snaking its way around a cigarette butt, a bottle cap about to be met by the river of steaming urine. I gazed at the projected point of intersection and saw a slip of paper lying on the ground. I bent down and snatched it up a moment before the two streams crossed paths and the larger artery flooded into the smaller one, coffee mixing with dog urine. And then the surface tension became exceeded by other forces and the swelling waterway spilled its banks and flooded encircled areas previously enjoying island status. I looked down and studied the writing on the slip of paper, an address of three ones, and I had to think of this concatenation of three, the truck, the dog, the unknown individual. Three factors mysteriously interconnected in an equation meant for me and me alone. And I thought of the hour, the minute before, and all three having no notion of their impending link. The person whose coffee had grown bitter or cold. The dog sniffing its way down a curb, accumulating the content, formulating the exact phrasing of the olfactory message it would presently leave behind. Someone examining the contents of his pockets to count out his loose change. Is it enough for a pack of cigarettes, or does he have to break a larger bill? And suddenly, finding the slip of paper that has already served its purpose and tossing it into a garbage bin and missing. but perhaps it fell out of his pocket accidentally. Perhaps the moment was yet to come when it would fulfill an important function, and the person was stopping and searching his pockets that very moment, several blocks away, trying to find the slip of paper with a certain address written on it, searching first one pocket and then another. And what will this lead to? And what will be lost as a consequence? Holding it now in my hand, it seemed as though I had been addressed in a language of happenstance, as though a voice were whispering a cryptic message into the din of occurrence, and I nearly became dizzy when I realized that I was the only person who had perceived it, and yet I understood nothing, nothing at all. I think I'm going to stop there, Brainerd. I have another paragraph, okay. But I think I'll stop there.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that was beautiful. That's a great place to stop, too. I love that section that you read, the beginning, you know, so evocative with all those images and, you know, it seems almost painterly in the way you're going through that. And then also this connection to other lives and how things end up and, you know, all these mysteries that can't be unraveled. Just really lovely. I love that. So what I'd like to ask you about is, you know, there's an article that you recently wrote, The Problem with Patriotism, A Critical Look at Collective Identity in the U.S. and Germany. You mentioned that a little bit at the beginning. And then there's this beautiful piece of writing that you just read. And you know, they're both, of course, very, very different. You know, your book, you know, for me is very poetic. It's all these gorgeous images and these worlds, and your article, of course, is more analytical about politics.
Yeah.
But there's some things in common. I mean, you know, you're so well versed, obviously, in the visual arts because you're a painter, and so you're talking about other artists in this article. But also, there's this constant duality between Germany and America, right? Berlin and New York. That I don't know how much that surfaces in your other writing, but that seems to be something that you're always looking at very closely. That relationship, in terms of your own, but also as a geographic, and a political relationship too. I mean, I'm trying to combine a bunch of things at once, but just this kind of duality that you have there that also pops up in this article where you're looking at collective identity.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're getting at. I think for me, probably what began as a personal dilemma, you could even call it. I mean, you pay a strange price when you live somewhere else, you know, in a culture that you didn't grow up in, when you make that decision to stay and you become a foreigner and you kind of stay a foreigner. Even when you try to go back home, you're still a foreigner. Many other people have written about this phenomenon. I'm not the first person to have noticed it, let's say, but it's you miss so much of the original culture when you're living in this other place, busy adapting and assimilating to another language and another cultural infrastructure, basically. There are so many things that are nonverbal that take years to learn, and once you're finally assimilated in one, you become quite alien in the other. And this was a personal problem for quite a long time. It leads to you know, certain states of alienation and homesickness and this and that and the other thing. And,
sure.
But what begins as a problem actually eventually turns out to become an advantage, because this distance that you gain, that you're sort of outside of, inside and outside of everything simultaneously, of course, it gives you the potential for a very different kind of critical eye, a different critical look at the place that you come from. And, you know, I think that this has occupied me, of course, very much since, as it has occupied all of us since the last election. But I've been trying, it took me quite a long time to write this essay, and it went through many different versions, but I really tried to pin down or articulate in any way at all this kind of very strange, alienated experience of seeing, perceiving the culture from the outside, and trying to put that into words, the strangeness of it, there's almost something surreal that happens at a certain point. You know, when you're taken out of, it's like you're taken out of one fishbowl and you're looking into that fishbowl from a different fishbowl or something like that. I don't really know if this metaphor works, but yeah. So
there is this expatriate kind of expat sort of point of view, but there's also, I mean, in all that you're saying, and especially in that article about collective identity, you mentioned a number of artists like Sophie Cow and Joseph Foyes and the work that they did that was also, because as you're saying, it's hard to, you know, get your mind around this, that, you know, it's kind of surreal what's happening, and it's easy to be sort of lost in, you know, what do we do, what can we do, how to even think about this. That the artists that you mentioned, Boys and Sophie Cow, are both did things that were somehow, I don't know if activist is the right word, but they were meant to be critical of the country.
Yeah.
You know, Boys and as you say, with a recent film by Andrzej Spiel, I think that was a great film that
Fire,
you talked about.
You
know, the article Bringing Your Son To, but also Boys, as I think you alluded to in the article, had this kind of activist position as an artist, really trying to change things and addressing the current political situation. So I guess I'm curious.
Well, Boyce was also a politician. I mean, he was a co-founder of the Green Party in Germany and ran for office. I mean, he was very, very serious about his political activity, and all of his teaching was of course highly political and got him thrown out of the Dusseldorf Academy. But he, I mean, what Sophie Carr did, her piece, The Detachment, was so brilliant because she came into Berlin just after, in the first couple of years after the wall came down, and she came in and did what only a foreigner can do, which is see the obvious. You know, people who are in the situation, I mean, if there's a taboo, it's usually something that's right out in the open, and it's staring you right in the face. And you really sometimes do need somebody coming from the outside. You need a foreigner, you need an alien to come in and state things clearly and succinctly. And that's exactly what she did with this piece, The Detachment. She encapsulated and articulated how quickly people were really forgetting what had been there before, as a lot of these emblems and insignia of the East German state were being taken away and leaving these blank spots behind. She would interview people on a bus stop where there had been a plaque commemorating some event that had happened. And she would interview people and ask them what they remembered of this, and they would have very vivid memories and be quite sure that it was like this, and they would describe it. And she would very laconically, in an exhibition or a catalog situation, just juxtapose, you know, these statements with what was actually on the plaque, and let the reader or the viewer draw their own conclusions. But she really captured the amnesia at work, basically. And this is why we definitely do need our aliens and our artists and our people who are coming from other places, because they have an ability to deactivate this kind of spellbinding that takes place. I really believe that.
That's very interesting, because that's different than also a kind of activist position, but the idea of an artist coming in, which is so interesting, you know, from the outside and seeing something that's obvious, because that also seems to tie into kind of what you're saying, as someone who is, you know, living in Germany but not born there, you're neither at home in New York or Germany, which also potentially lends to those insights, right? Seeing perhaps the obvious, whereas otherwise it can't be seen in either place, because you're actually sort of outside each sphere. Or am I reaching there a bit?
I'm probably more inside this sphere here than I am in America at this point, but I'm still American. I still feel very much American, and my heart is also very much with my background and my family and my culture and my friends and so on and so forth. But because I'm not really there, I'm not in the soup. I do think that I have a different perspective on things, and I think maybe that perspective can also sometimes be quite valuable. I dare to say, because what you do sometimes confront is this sense of no, you don't understand because you're not here. You know, I had this very kind of effect very, very strongly after 9/11, where I had a very different perception of what was going on. I was very, very alarmed by what was going on. I was very alarmed by the incredible call to patriotism, where it seemed to me it was time to stop and reflect and think about why this horrible event happened and what can we do now that's not, let's say, an act of revenge or not slightly insane. And it was not a popular thing to be right after 9/11, someone coming from the outside and voicing any kind of criticism. And this was for me a seminal experience in my relationship to my home country, that something like this could happen, and that I wouldn't be able to, let's say, communicate on a basic level even with very close friends who I thought were on the same page. And so I think, yeah, we are highly, highly manipulable as human beings, and we're very, very, very subject to our surroundings, and very much prey to the strategies in our media machines. There's no other way to put it, really. And so I think maybe it's good to step outside and take a look from another perspective, or at least listen to people who are offering another perspective, for sure.
Absolutely, and there is, and there certainly is another perspective, you know, in moving between these locations. And like you're saying, your view of 9/11, and now even your view of also these elections are from afar, which is perhaps what's given you that critical distance, so you can write an article like you've just written about collective identity, right? I mean, that's part of who you are, which is very interesting as an artist and as a person living in between two states. It's such a kind of I don't want to say homeless, but it almost seems like that gives you some kind of perspective that you otherwise wouldn't have, and is a peculiar vantage point, and perhaps an enormously helpful one in times like this, where it's easy to lose sight of what's fact and what's fiction.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope so. It's definitely the one advantage in a situation that also has disadvantages, I'll put it that way.
Great. It's great talking to you about your book, and congratulations on the new edition and the German translation. Do you want to say anything else about what you're working on now? I know we talked about that a little bit before.
Yeah. The last time that we did an interview, I was talking about the book that I'm still trying to finish, actually. And I think we've been talking for a long time now. I don't want to maybe talk about a whole other book, but there is another book in the works, and I hope to finish it in the next half year or so. I thought I was going to be done in the next half year 2 years ago. So I'm cautious with this kind of thing, but yeah.
I'll link to that past interview so people can hear about that too. But
great.
But books take time, right? I mean, that's part of the process, and you're also involved in this book as well. But your process of writing is one that isn't rushed, or you're not pushing towards a deadline. You're letting this come out of you, it seems, when it's ready to come out.
No, and I mean, we're all, you know, I mean, creative people, everybody that I know, we're all juggling some kind of job, you know, or many many jobs. I translate for a living. I translate a lot of art criticism, and I've been working on an idea for a radio play, actually, recently, that I adapted from material on my blog that I was doing a writing project about 4 years ago of miniatures based on love, and amassed quite a bit of material on that, and I had always wanted to do something with this, and then I was interviewed by a very nice radio person a month and a half ago, and we got into a conversation. I said, I love radio, I've always loved radio, and I used to be in the studio all the time. I listened to a lot of things on the radio when I was painting, standing up on a ladder and listening to the radio and painting dots, and I said I always had a fantasy about writing a radio play, and he said, well, we can talk about this, and I was completely taken aback because I wasn't really prepared with any ideas at that point, and I kind of just improvised, and just spent the last couple of weeks trying to turn this material into a dialogue, sort of based on, I think my departure point and my inspiration is a very lovely short piece by Marguerite Duras called In the Park. I think it's called In the Park. I read it in German translation years ago when people went around with bootleg versions of translations of texts in the 80s and the 90s in Berlin. We had that too, with people peddling books from bar to bar. And in this short piece by Marguerite Duras, there's a young woman and a young man, and they meet on a park bench, and they have a long conversation. It's delightful. It's really beautiful book. And of course, in some vague way, they start to, well, not quite fall in love, because they're talking about love, and they're talking about their weaknesses and their problems in life, and their inherent character problems and their poverty also. She's a nanny, and he's a traveling salesman, but the kind of traveling salesman that maybe sleeps on a park bench, and what he has to sell can fit into a small suitcase, basically. I'm very, very, very much living on the edge, and I've always loved this piece. And so I've turned it around, and I also have two people encountering each other on a park bench. The woman is at least 20 years older than this young man who's just been dumped by his girlfriend. And it's not really a love story, because they don't come together in that way, but they discover that they're quite related in the way that they both have a tendency towards becoming very excessive in love. And so I've developed this whole conversation, and I have no idea yet if they're going to say yes to it. So wish me luck. Mm-hmm. But it's been a lot of fun writing it. It's been nice.
That's good.
I'd love to work with actors. It'd be great.
That's exciting. Yeah. Well, I do wish you luck with that. That sounds really thrilling, actually. And let me ask you before we go, what are you reading right now? I'm always interested. But what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I'm reading a lot of things. Let me see what's here on my desk. I can say three things. One of my recent major discoveries, and she's amazing. I think she's one of the most amazing authors I've read in a long time, is Esther Kinsky. She actually just won a few months ago the prize at the Leipzig Book Fair. She's been translated widely into English, and I read her new book called Hein. I don't think that's been translated yet, but I think it's on its way. I think the book that I have here on my desk that I'm reading, the next book that I'm reading is, the English translation, I think, is At the River. And I met her young new translator. What's her name? Caroline. I can't think of her last name, but I'm very sure that when Hein comes out, it's going to come out in an excellent English translation. It's really worth reading. She's amazing. There are these very, very, very long, slow descriptions of, let's say, landscapes, but not landscapes in the sense of nature writing, more in the sense of the eye, let's say, wandering across the landscape, and then there's maybe a garbage dump, or there's some kind of rusted, you know, abandoned industrial infrastructure or something like that. And basically she's tracing consciousness through her descriptions of the environment, and it's exquisite writing. So that's one thing that I have here. And another is, I might be a bit slow, but I finally read one book of a trilogy of the Hungarian-Swiss writer Agota Kristoff, who I think it's called The Large Notebook in English. I read it in German translation. And it's told the persona of two young boys who are twins who are sent to their grandmothers in the countryside while the war is on. And it's one of the most raw psychological studies of what happens to, let's say, human morality during wartime. What becomes normal? How does sexuality express itself? How do power relations express themselves? And it's beautifully, beautifully written, very gently done, but there are also some very brutal, brutal truths in that book. And then the last book I'll mention is, she's just come out in German. She's in the same German-Austrian publishing house that I'm in. Her name is Ali Klein, and she just wrote a book named Carter that I hope comes out in English at some point. It's a beautiful book, and she read at the at this very prestigious Ingeborg Bachmann competition in Klagenfurt in Austria just a couple of weeks ago, and she did a beautiful job. I think it's a very, very compelling kind of writing. It'd be nice if something like that came into English at some point. And a bunch of other stuff, but my desk is...
Well, Andrea, I want to wish you luck with your next manuscript and potentially the play. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's great talking to you again, Brainerd. Yeah, take care. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.